From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's Kentucky Derby Day. Ahead on Only a Game, Jenny Reese previews the 136th run for the Roses, or we might just get a very entertaining weather forecast for Louisville. Also, gymnast Dominique Dawes joins me to discuss her most recent Olympic medal, awarded 10 years after she competed in Sydney, and a conversation with LPGA golfer Christina Kim. Also, the ups and downs, the joys, and the dangers of competitive yo-yo.
You certainly want to look out for rogue yo-yos. You can hear in the background yo-yos crashing. We're narrowly avoiding full contact with these yo-yos.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's Derby Day, the occasion upon which horse racing trots out the noble, the awesome, the super, and the lucky for a considerably larger number of fans than the sport enjoys on all its other days. Those familiar with today's Derby will recognize the references to Noble's Promise, Awesome Act, Super Saver, and Lookin' at Lucky. All horses entered in the run for the Roses. The morning line has the aforementioned Lookin' at Lucky winning, to the delight of at least some fans of alliteration. Joining me now from Churchill Downs to evaluate that prediction is Jenny Reese of the Louisville Courier-Journal, who, on behalf of Only a Game, has picked, Jenny, is it 16 or 17 consecutive Derby winners?
I've just lost count, all those winners in a row, just rattling off of my mouth.
Well, we're going to give you another chance today. There are numbers of intriguing Derby stories. One of them will have Devil May Care trying to establish that ongoing domination of the thoroughbred world by the fillies. You like her chances?
I really do like her chances. And if she wins, Todd Pletcher finally will win the Kentucky Derby after going 0 for 24 in 9 earlier runnings. But he'll also be 2 for 2 in Triple Crown races with a filly, having won the Belmont 3 years ago with the filly Rags to Riches. So I'm thinking maybe he changes his tactics, and from now on out, if she wins, he'll only enter fillies instead of colts, because after this race, if she wins, he'd be 0 for 27 with colts in the Kentucky Derby.
And, of course, Todd Pletcher had Escandrea, who looked like the favorite until about a week ago when he was scratched, but no problem for replacements at the ready.
Yes, and you know how we are. We always have a historical event that we can trot out situations like this. So after he announced about Escandrea coming out, I said, does it make you feel any better that in 1957, Ben Jones lost General Duke, the morning line favorite for the Kentucky Derby, like the day before the race or the morning of, I forget which, but won it with Iron Liege. And he just looked at me and said, oh yeah, that was the first thing I thought.
Sydney's Candy is said to have been working out well at Churchill Downs, so that's perhaps one reason to favor him. Another is that Candy is part of his name, and he's owned by Jenny Craig.
Yes, isn't that something that Jenny Craig, the diet maven, has all these horses by her sire Candy Ride, and she puts candy or chocolate, all these things in his name. Last year she had Chocolate Candy. Said, how can this be? How can Jenny Craig have a horse named Chocolate Candy and one named Sydney's Candy? I like this horse a lot in this race. He drew post 20, and that's not a terrific post for him. In fact, trainer John Sadler got a little tired of one of these turf rider statistics, pointing out, well, you know, it, you know, 2 years ago, Big Brown won from post 20. He goes, I should just get a button that says, yes, I know, Big Brown won from post 20.
I love it.
Now, Sydney's Candy's interesting because he's ridden by 20-year-old Joe Talamo, who came in last year, was riding the Derby favorite, I Want Revenge. That horse was scratched the morning of the race with an injury, and he was just devastated. Now he's back with a horse that's the second chance, the second choice in the race, and has a very good shot to win.
The Derby almost always has a big field, and that certainly is the case this time around. In a big field, horses and jockeys tend to get bounced around, especially at the start of the race. Any particular horses that have demonstrated that they don't mind mucking it up in the corners, to bring a hockey metaphor into the discussion?
Well, let's start with Lookin' at Lucky, the favorite. The joke around here has been he should be called Lookin' at Unlucky, because in three of his last four races, he's had traffic troubles. So he clipped heels and nearly fell when he won the Rebel Stakes at Oaklawn in his first start of the year. Then in a second race at Santa Anita, he got almost put into the rail by another horse, a long shot. And he certainly has been bounced around and has not spit the bit, as they said, has come on and, you know, run very well despite adversity. His owner, Mike Pegram, he said, you know, when people bring up the unlucky, he says, how can you say you've been unlucky when you have the favorite for the Kentucky Derby? He said, those two things just don't go together.
Well, he has the favorite and the horse has won six races. Not too shabby.
Absolutely, and he's made $1.5 million. Really not too shabby.
Weather sometimes figures in the Kentucky Derby. Some horses run better in the cold. Some certainly run better than others in the mud. What are we looking at today?
Forecast is terrible. Now, I hope the weatherman is tearing up a ticket himself on this, and his prediction of torrential rains and thunderstorms all day just is wrong. We'll find out, because there's different kinds of slop. It's a hard thing. It's already the hardest race in the world to handicap, the Kentucky Derby. Now you have to try to guess who will like the slop and who won't like the slop. And that's what it is. It's a guess.
Jenny, before we get to your dead certain lock, I'm curious about whether horse racing in Kentucky is facing the same changes that we're likely to see in Massachusetts. Will we see slot machines at Churchill Downs?
Probably not. And what you are seeing is a lot of horses leaving the state. I mean, you would not know it from this week. The crowds have been big. There's a lot of excitement in the air. But let's wait until next Thursday when racing resumes. And Churchill Downs grandstand's going to be empty. There will be very short fields. And it's sad. I'm not sure slots is the answer. It's a Band-Aid. And maybe it's a Band-Aid that these states need right now. But it's politics in Kentucky. Don't see it happening.
All right, let's move on to the real reason we're here. Most of the experts do seem to agree that even at relatively bad odds, 3-1 or thereabouts, looking at lucky is a smart choice. Are they right?
Well, my pick is the other bookend, Sydney's Candy from Post 20. I love looking at lucky, too. I think he's real live, and I certainly think he'll hit the board. But I think Sydney's Candy might be the most talented horse in the field.
Jenny Reese picks the Kentucky Derby winner once again for Only a Game, as she does each May, and she also writes for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Thank you, Jenny.
Always a pleasure.
Many of the horses competing at Churchill Downs today will travel in luxury to compete in the Preakness and in the Belmont Stakes. The lucky ones will then go on to lead quiet lives on pristine pastures with lots of agreeable company. But for less exalted equines, there's a less certain future. The horse world is struggling to keep up with a rising number of recreational animals let go by formerly wealthy owners. Only a Game's Emma Jacobs reports.
The horse back here is Rosie.
I'm in a dim barn, a half hour's drive north of Boston. Melissa Garib ducks under a chain to introduce me to Rosie, one of the horses under her care. Rosie looms over Melissa, who is 5'8".
She is a really, really sweet horse. She's a 6-year-old Percheron cross, so she's a draft horse, and she's gorgeous. And her owner really did a nice job bringing her up, did a lot of work with her. I think it was such a heartbreaking decision for her owner. She came to the point where she just couldn't afford to keep Rosie anymore. So she ended up bringing Rosie here, and we are looking to find a permanent home for her.
Garib is the barn manager at Nevin's Farm, a shelter in Methuen, Massachusetts, run by the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. The facility takes in unwanted farm and recreational animals from around New England.
We don't take in lions and tigers, but we take in cats and dogs and horses.
They're here because their owners couldn't afford to keep them any longer. There's Tigger, a thoroughbred who used to race, and Duke, a friendly mixed breed who is being rehabilitated.
People own them for riding, as pets, and something changed in their lives. Maybe they lost a job, maybe they were foreclosed upon, and they could no longer afford to care for them properly.
Stories like this have been on the rise since the start of the recession. In 2007, Nevin's Farm received 21 horses. In 2009, they received 70. They have already taken in 25 horses in the first quarter of 2010, and this is going on across the country.
The principal reason that owners have been forced to relinquish their horses has been that they can't afford them due to the downturn in the economy and the increased cost of feed and supplies for the horses.
Nat Messer is a professor of equine medicine at the University of Missouri. He represents the American Veterinary Medical Association on the Unwanted Horse Coalition. The coalition recently surveyed rescue farms around the country, and Messer says they are all struggling to care for the numbers of unwanted horses.
It would be nice, but there are no entitlement programs for horses like there are for people, so it's going to continue to be a problem, I think.
Many horses are being shipped to slaughterhouses in Canada and Mexico, but more than ever are turning up neglected or abandoned. Melissa walks me to one of the farm's horse pastures.
There are some people that don't recognize what they're doing to their horses. It could be anything except for not enough food. Just watch your step. It's really muddy here.
Five of the farm's newest arrivals are grazing alongside the highway. But as we approach, the horses don't look as healthy as others we've seen today. We walk across a ridge to find a light brown animal busy eating grass. Her ribs are showing.
So here's Mariah. Her coat was so poor and she was so uncomfortable that we ended up body clipping her. So that's why she has no hair now.
Horses' body weights are measured on a scale from 1 to 9. When she came in, Mariah was a 1. No former owners were willing to talk with me about leaving an animal. Melissa says losing a horse often comes on top of other more serious crises people want to forget about.
Anytime you take in an unhealthy animal, you just have to start going through your process.
Yeah.
And our eventual goal for all of them is to find them great new homes, and that's what we hope we can do.
In the long term, veterinarian Nat Messer says fewer horses should be bred. The Unwanted Horse Coalition is trying to get large players in the industry on board to cut the numbers of horses being produced. But for now, with no place to keep all the horses arriving at the farm, Nevins has had to redouble recruitment of foster families to house the animals until they find permanent homes.
Yeah, and just sit back and smooch if he acts like he's going to break.
Marty Gruer is one of the farm's foster parents. She took in a malnourished 2-year-old pony named Shorty in November.
When we first got Shorty, he's very friendly, but he would literally run into us because he didn't know to stop. he would do that with other horses, too. So, you know, personal space, just understanding some personal space here. And so he knows that now.
Marty's taken her one-on-one time with Shorty to train him up on the essentials. She hopes the time she's put in will help him find his own family.
You know, he can be with us as long as he needs to be with us. He's just a joy. But I'm really hoping that, you know, we'll be able to get Shorty to a place that he can have a real bond with a person that's his own. And I think he's going to be a great little pony someday for somebody.
For Only a Game, I'm Emma Jacobs.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Alonso's thumbs are a symbol, as well as being essential for driving a Formula One car. Thus spoke a spokesperson for banking giant Santander regarding the thumbs of champion race car pilot Fernando Alonso, who drives for the Santander team, and whose thumbs the bank has insured for 10 million euro, or about $13.3 million. Noting that Alonso, quote, made the sign of victory with his thumbs, the bank maintained that insuring said digits would guarantee, quote, that everything is under control and well protected. Regarding whether he valued his thumbs over, say, his heart, his legs, or perhaps his head, Alonso was unavailable for comment.
We are all dancing on God's thumb. We are all
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, LPGA golfer Christina Kim pitches her new book. Get it? Pitches? You know, probably she'll use a wedge. But first, on Wednesday, the U.S. Olympic women took team bronze in gymnastics. 10 years after they competed in Sydney, Dominique Dawes, Kristen Maloney, Amy Chow, Jamie Dancher, Elise Ray, and Tasha Swikert were awarded medals when the IOC concluded that China must forfeit the bronze from 2000. Chinese gymnast Dong Fang Xiao was 14 years old when she competed at the Sydney Games. Olympic rules stipulate that a gymnast must be 16 years old to qualify. Officials learned of her real birthday after she applied to be a technical advisor at the 2008 Beijing Games. Joining me now on the line is one of the USA's most recent Olympic medalists, Dominique Dawes. Dominique, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
What was your reaction when you learned that you had earned your third team medal?
I was not surprised because I had heard a great deal about this investigation for a number of years now. So when I got the news the other day, I wasn't surprised. But I will say that at 33 years old, getting another medal sure feels nice.
Some people might feel that winning a medal on a technicality is somehow disappointing or a lesser experience, but should it matter if a member of a national team is underage?
There is a rule in place, and obviously China did not follow that rule. So, you know, I do feel that the IOC and FIG, the Federation of International Gymnastics, did the right thing to catch the individuals that, you know, were not truthful and to, you know, strip them of their medal. We have rules in place to be followed, and I'm just thrilled that that justice prevailed and that FIG and IOC did their due diligence and didn't just give up after investigating it for a few months or just even a few years.
As you say, it is important to be forthcoming and honest in these competitions, but Dongfang Xiao was 14 years old. She perhaps couldn't have been expected to step forward and say, hey, I'm only 14, I shouldn't be here. Do you feel sympathy for her and for her teammates?
I'm glad you brought that up because these athletes from China, they don't have a say. They don't have a voice, and so they can't say, hey, I am only 14, I am breaking the rules. You know, this definitely isn't a win-win across the board at all for us Americans because it is a shame. And personally, I don't feel as if there really should be a minimum age. I think, you know, these athletes across all countries are training very hard even at 12 years old. And so I think if someone is capable mentally and physically to qualify to the Olympics at 13, I think they should be able to represent their country. Obviously, this proves that a 14-year-old can even kick our butts. But, you know, that being said, there was a rule in place. But I do believe that the FIG should reconsider that rule.
Have you been told by Olympic officials when you should start looking for a small but precious package from the post office?
I have not heard from anyone. I did receive some emails where it stated that it's official, but I haven't heard from, you know, anyone stating when I'm going to get it. Is it going to be a package in the mail? And I hope they don't lose that package. I have no clue at the moment, but it would be nice to get that team together sometime later this year to celebrate.
Dominique Dawes is a three-time Olympic medal winner, and she's working now as a motivational speaker as well as a gymnastics coach. Dominique, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Joining me now to discuss this week's decision by the IOC to strip Team China of the 2000 bronze medal and award it to Team USA is John Powers, who covers the Olympics for the Boston Globe. John, are you surprised at this result 10 years after the actual competition took place?
The reason for this is, unlike a doping decision where you can go back 8 years, it took a while to actually have the gymnast in question put on her real birth date in some place that they could trace. What's ironic is there was very little suspicion back in 2000. I don't remember the Americans complaining then. All of the Chinese girls looked pretty young, so not much was made of it.
Just a moment ago, Dominique Dawes told me that she was very happy that the International Olympic Committee had kept investigating this. Why weren't those officials at the IOC able to determine in 2000 that Dongfang Xiao was not old enough to compete?
That's always been an issue with the Chinese gymnasts, is that they are whatever age the government says they are. It's very difficult to get documents, passports that are original. And if Dong hadn't inadvertently or advertently put her real age down years later, it wouldn't have come up. This is a nice result for that American team. They felt very upset about not winning a medal. Don't forget they came in between the Magnificent Seven that had won the gold in Atlanta in 96 and the team that won the silver in 2004. This is a nice little payoff, especially for people like Dominique Dawes, Amy Chow, who came out of retirement to be able to do this.
Is there some sort of Olympic warehouse in Switzerland that stocks medals from each Olympiad for just such an occasion? And will Dawes and her teammates actually get those medals?
Well, I think normally what will happen is that they will ship the medals to the U.S. Olympic Committee, which will give it to USA Gymnastics, and they can have a little ceremony anytime they would like to. But, of course, this thing pales in terms of what could happen with the Marion Jones case, as we call it, Typhoid Marion. There were more than three dozen athletes who were affected by her doping in 2000, and those mostly it's an issue of should her relay mates lose their medals. So far, they are losing them, but they are on appeal. But that would be the mother of all warehousing. Then you'd be, you know, rummaging around for spare bronzes forever.
John, there were questions regarding the ages of some of the Chinese gymnasts at the Beijing Olympics just 2 years ago. Are you aware of any developments in that story?
Right now, as far as the IOC is concerned, that case is closed. The International Gymnastics Federation, the FIG, they have decided that the documents they saw from the Chinese athletes were legitimate. Now, what could happen, and again down the road, is one of those gymnasts inadvertently or advertently puts your real age back again. Mm-hmm. One of the issues that, for example, is big now is how far back you can go. 8 years you can go back in doping. How far back can you go in something like this? The all-time delayed reaction was for Jim Thorpe. I believe it took him like 50 years to get his medals back, and he was already dead.
John Powers covers the Olympics for the Boston Globe. We awarded him the Only a Game silver medal for his 1994 coverage from Lillehammer, but on further review, I think it's a gold. How's that sound, John?
We do love inflation.
In Swinging from My Heels, Confessions of an LPGA Star, Christina Kim, with the assistance of Sports Illustrated's Alan Shipnuck, provides readers with a look at life on the LPGA Tour. Or at least with a look at Christina Kim's life there. Christina Kim joins me now on the line. Christina, welcome to Only a Game.
No, thank you so much for having me.
And welcome also to Alan Shipnuck, who's in the studio at KAZU in Seaside, California. Hi, Alan.
Hello.
Christina, I want to start with you. You discussed the 2009 golf season as a time during which you grew up. What did that mean beyond putting some distance between yourself and your parents?
Well, you know, everything from, you know, me going through a slight, you know, physical transformation of getting into fitness and nutrition, working out, you know, losing some weight, to figuring out who I am as a human being in terms of, you know, what it is I want from my career, what it is that I want to, you know, leave when I leave this planet. You know, it was a year of growth for me. I just turned 26, but as a 25-year-old in the most elite echelon of golfing play, you know, it was a big year of growth for me in many, many ways.
Alan, I assume when you decided to write this book, you were hoping that Christina would win the U.S. Women's Open and half a dozen other tournaments as well. Were you disappointed that it didn't work out that way?
Actually, I'm hoping she'll win those tournaments this year. It's part of our carefully orchestrated marketing plan.
Ah, but
certainly, that would have put a nice happy ending on the book if she'd won at the end of the year. But I think one of the things that makes the book so compelling is that there are the struggles, and Christina's very honest and open about sort of the mental torture that is part of tournament golf. And from Rudy on down, we're used to seeing sports movies where it always has the big crescendo at the end and the hero always scores the touchdown or whatever it may be. And that's how we're conditioned. And this book is a little more complicated than that. And really the story of the book is her growth as a person. And it was a lot of hard knocks, but I think that, you know, she learned from them and she really evolved as the season went on. So there was just enough triumph on the golf course to really make it interesting, and that was kind of leavened by some tough spots. But a victory would be nice, but I don't think it was essential to the narrative.
In Swinging from My Heels, Christina, you are effusive in your praise of Lorena Ochoa, the most successful player on the LPGA Tour for the last several years. You write that playing with her in Mexico is like playing with the Pope, and that people come up and hand their babies to her, hoping that some of the magic will rub off. But since you wrote the book, Lorena Ochoa has announced her retirement. To what extent will that hurt the tour?
In my book, I did prophesize, if you will, that Lorena was going to be leaving the tour sooner than a lot of people had suspected. You know, I kind of call her sort of like our version of the Halley's Comet, because she's just going to do a flyby on you. You're going to be a very, very fortunate person to see her as she flies by in our generation. I think that she's never going to be forgotten. She's always going to have her name and face in the world of golf, and I think that it's a huge blow for the LPGA Tour, without a doubt, because it's always tough to lose your number one. We had to go through that with Annika Sorenstam several years ago, but at the same time, you know, this is a perfect opportunity for a lot of young hungry players like myself, Paula Creamer, Michelle Wee, to really go out and try and attain that number one spot now. So we're actually in a very exciting place in terms of where we are with Lorena stepping away.
You have lots of complimentary things to say about many of the players on the tour. Aren't there any bad people out there on the LPGA Tour?
You know, if there were any bad people on the LPGA Tour, I would probably be the last one to notice. I live my life in joy, positive energy, love, and just happiness. You know, I have the world's greatest job, and I'm thankful for it every single day of my life, but I don't have time for negative people in my life. So if they are there, they're obviously not a part of my circle of friends.
And by the way, Bill, I asked the same question a few times. Uh-huh. I could never get out of her. So
A few times. You ask me like every week. You're like, come on, tell me something juicy about someone you don't like. Every week. And I'm like, I don't even know. If there are people I don't like, I don't even recognize their existence.
Alan, when Christina talks about her lack of endorsement opportunities during the first several years of her pro career, the phrase non-traditional appeal comes up. Was it her non-traditional appeal that led you to get involved in this collaboration?
Well, no question. You know, Christina, I've always thought she's one of the funniest people in professional sports, let alone professional golf. And I've been a fan of hers going back to 2004 when I did a feature about her for Sports Illustrated. Lorena is actually kind of a missing link in this tale, because I was doing a story about her, about Lorena in 2008 for SI, and went to a tournament in Virginia that Christina almost won. She was in the press room all week, and I was just a reminder of how funny she is and how lively, and she was a great voice in my story about Lorena. And after that story came out, I started talking to Lorena's people about doing a book. But in my heart, I knew it was destined to be kind of a boring book. And I was thinking of ways to make it a little livelier. It didn't work out with Lorena, but all that thinking about how can you write an interesting book about the LPGA Tour, it just dawned on me. The only person who can really do it is Christina Kim. Mm-hmm. She's so uncensored. She's so candid. She's a contrarian thinker. And it was just, she's just a genuinely fun person to be around, and to kind of be in her world for a year was a real treat.
Christina, you and lots of other golfers on the tour have demonstrated, and this was new to me, but you've demonstrated that you can thrive and prosper financially by consistently finishing in the top 30, 40, 20 or so. Does that have an impact on motivation as far as wanting to go out and win every day?
You know, for me, I don't really care about things on a monetary standpoint in the sense of, oh, well, if I finish third place, I'm still going to make a lot of money. If I finish in third place, I'm pissed off that I did not win. Just like anything else that I do in life, my theory is go big or go home. And so if you go and end up winning a tournament by five strokes, even though I haven't done that in years, or if you were to do go big or go home, you go big and you go too big and you end up missing the cut, then it's time for you to go home. But for me, I love the idea of just going full throttle. And, you know, I'm very, very fortunate that I'm able to survive off of what I do. You know, because I love the game, and the game has been so good to me. And look where we are now. You know, never in my entire life would I have thought that I'd be doing an interview with NPR for a book that I wrote because of a game that I picked up, you know, some 14, 15 years ago.
Well, and one thing we get into in the book is that there really is a disparity in the women's game versus the men's game. The person who finished 100th on the money list on the PGA Tour is going to make $1 million. On the LPGA Tour, they make $90,000, and that barely covers their expenses. So in some ways, the LPGA is a throwback where you still have some players driving from tournament to tournament. They're borrowing money from their parents. They're maxing out their credit cards. I mean, there is really a pressure to perform that adds a little more urgency to every tournament, every round.
I'm speaking with Alan Shipnuck and Christina Kim, who collaborated on the new book, Swinging From My Heels. You're listening to Only a Game. Christina, your goals for 2009, the year about which the book is written, were to make the Solheim Cup team and to win a tournament. You accomplished the former, did not accomplish the latter. What about your goals for 2010?
You know, for me, obviously I can sit there and say, you know, the stock standard answer of I want to win more tournaments, I want to get into the Hall of Fame, I want to do this, I want to do that. And of course, that's definitely something I would love to do. But this book has helped me in so many ways. I am so much more fearless right now with everything that I do in life. You know, I feel liberated. I feel empowered. And so one of my goals is to just maintain that feeling of empowerment. And one of the goals I have for my season in terms of playing is to hit a round where I hit every shot perfect. Whether that means shooting 54, 55, or if that means shooting 94, 95, as long as I know that every stroke and every strike of mine was perfect, then, you know, I'm going to be pretty happy.
On the morning that you wake up and know that you're going to shoot 54, would you please alert me so that I can get a plane to that tournament?
I'll call you after the fact. I can't promise you when it happens.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is interesting in the book is tracking Christina's performance and her mood and how closely aligned they are. And there's so many highs and lows for her off the golf course, and a lot of it gets played out between the ropes as well. And there's such a mental component to golf. It's not a reactionary sport. You know, the ball is just sitting there waiting for you to hit it. And as Christina navigated through a very turbulent season, you know, she's very candid about all the things that are happening to her and how that's affecting her focus and how that's affecting her enthusiasm. And just for me as a fan, as someone who chronicles the game, it was interesting to see that the cause and effect between how she felt when she showed up at the golf course and what scores she shot.
Alan Shipnuck collaborated with Christina Kim on Swinging From My Heels, published by Bloomsbury, and he's been speaking with me from KAZU in Seaside, California. Alan, thank you very much.
That was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Christina Kim joined us by phone, and I'm sure that as soon as she puts the phone down, she'll be headed to the practice tee. Christina, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I am going to go out, actually, and start swinging from my heels.
To read my review of Swinging From My Heels or any of the books you've heard featured on Only a Game, visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter, username Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
On April 22nd, while he was dutifully and quietly sitting in the penalty box, Chicago Blackhawks defenseman Duncan Keith was harassed by a fan of the opposition Nashville Predators. The fan implied that Keith wasn't worth the money the Blackhawks were paying him. He said that later that night, one of his family members would be pulling the fire alarm in the hotel where the Blackhawks were staying. At that point, Duncan Keith carefully aimed his water bottle and doused the fan. In a rare, welcome, and exceedingly un-NFL-ish show of common sense and perspective, the National Hockey League decided this week to take no action against Duncan, the water squirter. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, listen to the story about yo-yos, you yo-yo. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
You got a pick for the Derby today?
I do. I'm going to go with the young lady, Devil May Care. Both favorites got terrible pole positions. One of them is the very first, and one of them is the 20th. So I'm going to pick a horse in the middle of the field, Devil May Care. She's got a little Seattle slew way back in there, so that's where I'm going.
The Los Angeles Lakers closed out their first-round series against the Oklahoma City Thunder last night, but I have a feeling Kevin Durant and cohorts will roll into round two and perhaps beyond next season. What do you think?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. If they manage to keep their team together and not look at what they've done this year as any kind of peaking, which I think is probably the problem we have right now with the Atlanta Hawks, who had a terrific playoff series a couple of years ago against the eventual champion Celtics and apparently determined at that point that they'd actually won something. So if Oklahoma looks at this terrific postseason they've had as just one more step in the process, then they'll be fine.
Rumors hit the web this week that Lakers guard Derek Fisher had been in an altercation at a Waffle House in Oklahoma City last week. Fisher has denied being in any altercation, but he has yet to deny eating at a Waffle House.
I was about to say, the most disturbing part of this story is that there was a rumor about Derek Fisher being in the Waffle House. You're an NBA player, dude. Kick it up a notch. Go to Applebee's.
The Dallas Mavericks were knocked out of the playoffs by the Spurs on Thursday night, making this the third of 4 years that the Mavs have failed to win a playoff series. More surprisingly, Mavs owner Mark Cuban, quiet, even introspective after the loss. Have I got that about right?
Yes, the world's smartest human who keeps running his mouth and putting together teams that can't win the championship despite the talent he puts on them has decided that he's not so proud of the NBA because he's not proud of his, quote, inability over the last 10 years to have the impact like I want to have. Don't worry about it, Mark.
The Cavaliers will face Boston in the Eastern Conference semifinals starting today, but apparently LeBron James is suffering from an arm injury. Do you think he'll be shooting left-handed free throws each of the 65 to 70 times he gets to the line?
Well, judging by the accounts of this elbow injury, apparently what he has is kind of a recurring amputation of his right arm.
Yikes.
Because all of a sudden he's at death's door and the next minute he's fine. I believe this is a lot of gamesmanship.
By the day after a game, even a playoff game, most NBA players have cooled off enough so that they avoid saying anything that they'll be fined for saying. But apparently that does not apply to Dwight Howard of the Orlando Magic.
No, he came out after a day off and blogged that he was sick of the officiating in the NBA. David Stern has decided to, quote, announce his presence with authority and start saying things like, make my day. Guess what, David? Your referees stink. They're getting worse. They can't keep up with the game, and they don't know the rules. So, yeah, fine Dwight Howard if you want, but don't ignore the problem.
Can he fine you?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, we're all right then. The NHL's second round has begun. Which of the four conference semifinal series do you look to for a little hockey excitement?
Well, I think that probably the most evenly matched one are the Bruins and the Flyers. You're talking about a 6 seed and a 7 seed. I am rooting wholeheartedly for an all-original six Final Four, which can still happen. You can still have Detroit and Chicago in the West and Montreal and Boston in the East. And we're going to dig up Dan Kelly and bring him back for the play-by-play.
The Tampa Bay Rays have set a new team record for number of wins in the first month Woo-hoo! Of the season, and they are enjoying the best start in Major League Baseball since back in 2003. Of course, now that we've mentioned them here on Only a Game, they will most certainly lose the next 10 games
in
a row.
They'll spend the next 2 weeks turning to concrete, absolutely. This is a really fun baseball team. This is a baseball team that if you are a fan of another team, you get tickets to go out and watch them play. Plus, their pitching has been much better than people thought it was going to be.
Blue Jays catcher John Buck has been in a bit of a slump lately, so on Thursday afternoon he showed up early and took some extra batting practice, and on Thursday night against the A's, Buck hit not one, not two, but three home runs. So, catchers everywhere now lining up for extra batting practice.
I don't know, but I think, you know, Toronto's hitting coach Dwayne Murphy can probably hang out a shingle right now and say, you know, slump's fixed while you wait.
If you'd asked me, Charlie, before I did my homework this week to name the most hated team in Major League Baseball, I would have said the Yankees, followed closely by the Red Sox, and I would have been wrong, right?
You're absolutely right. The most despised team in baseball is the Cleveland Indians. Mm. Can you please explain to me why? They've never done anything to inconvenience anybody, including winning a World Series.
They don't even cause traffic jams.
They don't cause any problems. They don't beat your team in the playoffs or anything. What is wrong with these people?
All right, somebody will always be the oldest player in the National Football League, but this season, I guess it will no longer be New York Giants punter Jeff Eagles.
No, he's going to retire. He's 44 years old. He will leave a long NFL career with his mental faculties largely intact, and good for him.
That's because when you knock the punter down, you get penalized a lot,
right.
So they don't do that too much. When the New York Red Bulls faced the Philadelphia Union in MLS action last weekend, there was a clear indication, I think, that soccer in the U.S. can rival soccer anywhere in the world in at least one sense. You want to take it from there?
There was hooliganism, or as it says on the intertubes, hooligan wannabes. Apparently, the Red Bulls fans threw rocks at a bus carrying the Philadelphia supporters, and I don't even want to think what the Philadelphia supporters are going to come up with in response.
There have been calls for a change in the judging criteria for the Miss America contest. People say that a stamina contest should be added to the swimsuit, evening wear, and talent competitions. Why is that?
Caressa Cameron, the incumbent Miss America, got knocked down by the heat and wasn't able to sing the national anthem Sunday at Talladega before the NASCAR races. That's really too bad, because if there's one place in America that screams Miss America, it's Talladega.
And finally, can you explain to me this listing in the classifieds, seeking the smallest jockey ever?
First of all, may I say, sports!
There's Kentucky Derby horses.
There's a Pinto Stallion born in Barnstead, New Hampshire, named Einstein, and he weighed just 6 pounds and measured 14 inches tall when he was born. It is the world's smallest horse, beating the record of the previous record holder, whose name was Thumbelina.
Of course it
and
was.
I guarantee you that if he was in the Kentucky Derby, Einstein there, and I bet against him, he'd win.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie. As the four most successful college hockey teams in the nation prepared to determine a champion a few weeks ago, Charlie Pierce opined that the team from Rochester Institute of Technology shouldn't have been among them. This dismayed Rachel Miller no little and quite some. Ms. Miller hears Only a Game on WXXI in Rochester, and she wrote, "Charlie Pierce does it again. The fact that RIT even made it to the Frozen Four in only their fifth year in Division I speaks volumes for their dedication, and despite their loss, they were welcomed home by the RIT community as returning heroes. Charlie's remark was uncalled for, to put it mildly." We also heard from CM Daly, who listens to the program on WFPL in Louisville. Regarding the program 2 weeks ago, she wrote, "You missed the biggest story from your town, the Boston Marathon. What an incredible oversight. You call yourself a sports show?" The foregoing was all in capitals, and "you call yourself a sports show" was followed by 3 question marks and 4 exclamation points, which is quite a lot. John Halloran, a WVUR listener, enjoyed our use of the Public Image Limited song Seattle out of our conversation with two filmmakers 2 weeks ago regarding the Sonics' departure from Seattle. Another fine example of the clever thought that goes into the musical portion of the show, he wrote. That program also included a story about pro football players behaving badly or stupidly or criminally or all of the above. As part of that story, I spoke with Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com, and what he said provoked this response from Laura Novak, who hears Only a Game on WCPN in Cleveland. "I'm sure you receive more than your share of outraged letters," she wrote. "I was, however, very disappointed that you let pass without comment the statement by Greg Doyle that the accusations against Ben Roethlisberger were, quote, a witch hunt. Ben Roethlisberger's behavior was appalling, and the newspaper reports are clear that it is a lack of DNA evidence and not a lack of credibility hampering the case. As a lifelong Steelers fan, I pride myself on the team's long history of getting rid of troublemakers and criminals, even when they are talented players. I fully expect the Rooneys to do the right thing. Thank you. I love your show." You can register your comments on stories, commentaries, conversations, and outbursts by Charlie by visiting our always evolving website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also contact us at facebook.com/onlyagameradio, and you can follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio.
You see, we have a lefty and a righty. We've got Kylie and Trent here. They're getting ready. I'm going to give you guys a couple more throws, and then we're going to do this for real.
That's public address announcer slash DJ Brett Uchkunas, whose friends call him Ooch. In the auditorium of the JFK Middle School in Northampton, Massachusetts, on Sunday, the aforementioned Kylie and Trent, 8 and 9, respectively, are about to face off against each other in the Northeast Regional Yo-Yo Championships.
Are you ready?
Challenged to pull off the trapeze move, Kylie hits it flawlessly and agrees shortly thereafter to speak to the press.
"I don't know. I think I was just lucky because I usually don't get trapeze and I'm supposed to get it. And I..."
You got it on your first try.
Yeah, that's what I was really happy about, that I actually got it.
She not only got it, Kylie Livernoy finished first in the tightly contested age 5-9 division, which, according to Brett Uchkunas, may constitute the beginning of a new beginning.
"In the 90s, we had a world champion who was a girl. We haven't had one since. And I think that we're seeing some real promising talent coming up from Western Mass. And saw it here first."
I saw a lot of things for the first time on Sunday. Judges counting sought-after and challenging string hits with clickers and keeping strict track of how closely the movement of each high-tech ball-bearing yo-yo coincided with the beat of the accompanying music each competitor had chosen. A trick yo-yo made entirely of plumbing supplies, proud parents, and danger, about which I was warned by Brett Uchkunas himself.
You certainly want to look out for rogue yo-yos. That's the one thing I would look out for.
Yo-yos sailing across the room.
Yeah, exactly. You can hear in the background yo-yos crashing. For anyone who's listening, we're narrowly avoiding full contact with these yo-yos.
The culture of the yo-yo is vibrant, even rampant, in Northampton. That's thanks in large part to the efforts of Jack Finn, proprietor of the A to Z Science and Learning toy store in town. For years, Finn has provided clinics for the yo-yoers, fed them pizza, and encouraged their efforts in various other ways. Among Finn's flock is 10-year-old Shane O'Donnell, who would like to compete someday in the national championships held each fall in California. O'Donnell began yo-yoing when he was six, and he has a plan.
Yeah, I hope to get sponsored by, like, a company, and I hope to be really good at yo-yoing. And you don't really make money yo-yoing, so it can't be, like, your main job or something. But, yeah, I love yo-yoing.
You sound very wise for your years. You've got this figured out.
Yeah, I guess so.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's give them a big round of applause. They did a great job. You are now free to roam about the building.
Yo-yoing in Northampton and elsewhere is not strictly a pastime for children, and Jack Finn's store is not just a place for kids to trade yo-yo tricks. In fact, according to Shane's dad, James O'Donnell, A2Z is the store and the stuff of legends.
We're in the toy store having class. Everybody's learning their tricks. And a gentleman walked in with a gray beard, late 70s, long gray beard, longer hair. Standing around staring at all the kids. And
this is worrisome, an old man staring at all the kids, right?
Well, you said, oh, this is Northampton. We don't get too shook up about any characters walking around here, you know? So he's standing there, so he asked me, can I try your yo-yo? And I said, sure, here. And he took it, and he started doing trapezes, double or nothings, and I was like, wow, look at this, you know? And I go, I got to ask you, how did you get so good? And he said he was a 1968 yo-yo champion. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, I got all the kids together to come and look at him, and show that, you know, there's kids 6 to late 70s, this guy was there. He was unbelievable. He was really good.
And then he disappeared.
And then he just walked away, and it was like a ghost, and we didn't even get his name or nothing. It was quite a day.
As James O'Donnell recounted for me the legend of the ancient yo-yoer, a man who may be a legend in the making was doing some tricks at the other end of the corridor outside the auditorium. John Robinson, a.k.a. John Robb, who'd traveled to Northampton from Delaware for the competition, was surrounded by a group of admirers, though what John Robb was doing didn't look like any yo-yoing I'd ever seen.
I've always competed in counterweight, which is the 5A division, which is strings attached to the yo-yo, but has a counterweight attached to the end.
The string is attached to the yo-yo, but it has a counterweight attached to the end, meaning it's not attached to your finger.
Yes, sir.
Counterweight appears to me to combine the arts of yo-yoing, juggling, and three-card Monty, which, in John Robb's case at least, seems a reasonable comparison.
I don't come up here for the money. I come up here for the pats on the back, you know what I'm saying, and reputation kind of thing. But if they get money, I'll be happy to take it from them, you know, so they give it away.
I hesitate to ask because there's so many children here, but do we see side bets? Do we see people betting on their own talent?
Sometimes. I mean, last year we had some contests with some underground betting, but it's more for, like, bragging rights and who's better than who type of thing in their little competition. But, I mean, I do it for the pride and the recognition, of course.
That's a good thing. There were multiple divisions based on age and expertise at Sunday's regionals, but nobody who topped any of them got anything but a trophy or a medal. Apparently, that was motivation enough for John Robb, who finished first in the 5A division with a perfect score of 100, a convincing 16 points ahead of the second-place finisher. Another success in the adult division of the competition was Timothy Tilstra, who yo-yos the old-fashioned way. At 33, Tilstra said he felt no discomfort at the recognition that most of the competitors surrounding him were less than half his age.
No, I think it's great. In fact, all the kids, you know, the 10, 11-year-old kids, they're all better than me. And I think that's wonderful, you know. When I get to learn something from them, that's really great.
Tilstra says he's been seriously into yo-yoing for about 2.5 years. He writes web applications for the New York State Archives in Albany, and I asked him if holding down a full-time job put him at a disadvantage as far as practicing his passion was concerned.
Oh, no, actually, my job involves a lot of thinking, and I get up and I walk around and I play the yo-yo, I do other things to get my mind clear, to give me a better insight into my projects.
And your supervisor wouldn't mind if he or she were to walk around the corner and see you playing with the yo-yo?
My supervisor loves it. My old supervisor actually requested personally that I teach him how to solve a Rubik's Cube. So they're really a great bunch of people over there.
This sort of tolerance, even celebration, of the toy-related skills of an adult in the workplace made me wonder if it's ever necessary to outgrow yo-yoing. Jack Finn, the proprietor of the A to Z Science and Learning Toy Store, Mr. Yo-Yo himself, as far as the Northeast regionals are concerned, gave me my answer.
You don't have to. You don't have to. I didn't start yo-yoing until I was 50, so I got a really slow start.
Are you any good?
Compared to these kids, no. I'm not. Not. I'm wishing. It's back and forth.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from David Whitrock at KAZU in Seaside, California. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on our Facebook and Twitter pages at Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from ripped yo-yoist Johnny Del Valle, who offers a rare yo-yoing negative.
Unfortunately, yo-yoing doesn't really give you a body conditioning, so I have to train outside of my yo-yoing practice in order to, you know, keep my body well conditioned.
I would have thought a two-handed yo-yoist could have really gotten pumped there, but I guess not. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, LendingTree with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at WallaceFoundation.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. This is NPR.